Okay, no, I'm very happy to do it.
I mean, I personally, I would never force it on anybody else, but I think, you know, without an understanding of that, sometimes very difficult to get an idea of what Buddhism's all about and how it's evolved. And also to understand how they relate to one another. Because some people think it's about rejecting one and doing the other, and it's not. They're like Russian dolls. The Pali canon and the Theravada is absolutely foundational, and then the Mahayana develops from it, but it's not inimical to it, quite the reverse. It's like a tree growing. Yeah, and then the Vajrayana out of that, and Zen and all these other things. But they're all, you know, it's like Brighton Rock, you know. Brighton Rock is through it to the core, and that core is the teaching of the Buddha.
Yeah.
So yes, good, and all are needed. It's not as if people ladder it from one to the other.
Yeah.
It's and also they're kind of different approaches.
Mm.
You know, if there weren't other forms of Buddhism, or I wasn't particularly interested in this, yeah, I could quite happily just drop into a Theravada way of life. Fine.
Mm.
No problem. Maybe I couldn't have done when I started, but I can now. Even though I started with Theravada Buddhism. And I don't think I would understand or be doing what I was doing now if I didn't understand that one. Anyway, that's fun. I'll take advantage of a little bit of slack, and because it is Halloween and there was an interest. The Saltram Alioni is indeed called Feeding Your Demons, yeah. You probably get it really cheaply now in all sorts of places. Feeding Your Demons, yeah. Anyway, there was so much interest in it that it was very easy then to pull it out. So if you want to, for the next 15, 20 minutes, I'll guide you through it as a meditation. I'll just read you a little bit to give you a bit of context and a bit of background, but not too much. And this is her writing. Feeding our demons rather than fighting them contradicts the conventional approach of fighting against whatever assails us. But it turns out to be a remarkably effective path to inner integration. Demons, maras in Sanskrit, called maras, yeah? Demons, maras in Sanskrit, are not bloodthirsty ghouls waiting for us in dark corners. Demons are within us. They are the energies we experience every day, such as fear, illness, depression, anxiety, trauma, relationship difficulties, and addiction. Anything that drains our energy and blocks us from being completely awake is a demon. The approach of giving form to these inner forces and feeding them rather than struggling against them was originally articulated by an 11th century female Tibetan Buddhist teacher named Machig Labdron, 1055 to 1145. The spiritual practice she developed was called Chö. Sometimes people emphasize the D so it becomes Chod, but Chö, Chod. And it generated such amazing results that it became very popular, spreading widely throughout Tibet and beyond. In today's world, we suffer from record levels of inner and outer struggle. We find ourselves ever more polarized inwardly and outwardly. We need a new paradigm, a fresh approach to conflict. Machig's strategy of nurturing rather than battling our inner and outer demons offers a revolutionary path to resolve conflict and leads to psychological integration and inner peace. The method that I have developed, called Feeding Your Demons, is based on the principles of Chö, adapted for the Western world. Right, so here's an abbreviated version of her practice in five steps. To do Chö practice, you need an empowerment. It's a tantric practice and it's a ritual practice. But what she's doing here is she's taking out a meditation which embodies the psychological aspects of it that anybody can do. It's Halloween, let's go for it. So,
is the recording on? Is the recording on?
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, to the extent to which you you'll get something out of this is to the extent to which you're prepared to have a bit of guts. Because you could just sit and listen to what I'm saying and pick something that's a long way away. I'd kind of recommend you pick something that you find really disturbing in yourself or that's a real issue. She's given you quite a lot of categories of things to choose from. But there's got to be a willingness to go to the things that are problematic for you, that are demons, that do frighten you, that do scare you, that really do throw you off, yeah? If you don't do that, then there's not going to be much benefit in the practice. So when it says pick one, yeah? Okay, if you're thinking, no, I don't want to go there, then you can just listen and hear the principles. But in order to get any juice from the practice, you do need to be prepared to have the kind of honesty and a bit of guts to say, oh, yeah, I know the one I'm going to feed right now. Yeah? Anyway, let's give it a go, because it is, yeah, it is, and so it relates to what we're doing. So step one, as I've suggested, is finding the demon in your body, yeah? So after generating, you bring the motivation again, you know, that why you're doing the practice, really quite important. You bring the intention, you bring the motivation that you're doing this not just for yourself, but to be of benefit to you and all sentient beings. And that the benefits of the practice should enable you to be more beneficial to all sentient beings. So important to have that motivation of universal altruism. So after generating a heartfelt motion to practice for the benefit of yourself and all beings, decide which demon you want to work with. Choose something that feels like it's draining your energy right now. If it's a relationship issue, work with the feeling that's arising in you in the relationship as the demon rather than as the other person. Thinking about the demon you have chosen to work with, perhaps remembering a particular incident when it came up strongly, scan your body and ask yourself, where is the demon held in my body most strongly? What is its shape? What is its colour? What is its texture? And what is its temperature? Yeah? And that, you remember, yesterday we were looking that if we settle on feelings, whether they be sensations or emotions, those two can be related. They can also be related to a thought. So that'll give you some... So if you're clear about that, choose what it is you want to work with. She's, I think, very wisely suggested something that you sense is actually draining you from energy right now, rather than inventing something or thinking back into the past. And then try and think, where is it most strongly held in the body? What's its shape? What's its colour? What's its texture? What's its temperature? And once you've got there, intensify that sensation. Then allow this sensation with its colour, texture and temperature to move out of your body and become personified in front of you as a being with limbs, a face, eyes and so on. Notice the following about the demon: size, colour, surface of its body, density, gender, if it has one, its character, its emotional state. Look in its eyes. Something about the demon you did not see before. Now ask the demon the following questions. What do you want? What do you really need? How will you feel when you get what you really need? What do you want? What do you really need? How will you feel when you get what you really need? Then, keeping your eyes closed as much as possible, switch places. Take a moment to settle into the demon's body. Feel what it's like to be the demon. Notice how your normal self looks from the demon's point of view. Answer these questions, speaking as the demon. What I want is. What I really need is. When I get what I really need, I will feel. Take particular note of this answer. Take a moment to settle back into your own body. See the demon opposite you. Then dissolve your own body into nectar. The nectar has the quality of the feeling that the demon would have when it gets what it really needs. Notice the colour of the nectar. Imagine this nectar is moving towards the demon and nurturing it. Notice how the demon takes it in. you have an infinite supply of nectar. Feed the demon to its complete satisfaction and notice how it transforms in the process. Notice if there's a being present after the demon is completely satisfied. If there is a being present, ask it, are you the ally? If it is, you will work with that being. If it is not, or there's no being present after feeding the demon to complete satisfaction, invite the ally to appear. When you see the ally, notice all the details of the ally: size, colour, surface of its body, density, gender, if it has one, its character, its emotional state, the look in its eyes, something about the ally you did not notice before. When you feel really connected with the energy of the ally, ask these questions. How will you help me? How will you protect me? What pledge do you make to me? How can I access you? Change places and become the ally. Take a moment to settle into the ally's body and notice how it feels to be in the ally's body. How does your normal self look from the ally's point of view? When you are ready, answer these questions, speaking as the ally. I will help you by, I will protect you by, I pledge I will, you can access me by. Take a moment to settle back into your own body and see the alloy in front of you. Look into its eyes and feel its energy pouring into your body. Now imagine that the alloy dissolves into light. Notice the colour of this light. Feel it dissolving into you and integrate this luminosity into every cell of your body. Take note of the feeling of the integrated energy of the alloy in your body. Now you, with the integrated energy of the alloy, also dissolve. Just rest in whatever state is present after the dissolution. Pause until discursive thoughts begin again. Then gradually come back to your body. As you open your eyes, maintain the feeling of the energy of the alloy in your body. So, before we go back, there was something in here, because I think it's kind of good to kind of connect a bit with the motivation for why we're doing what we're doing, otherwise it can sometimes seem a bit dry. So, there was a nice piece in His Holiness's book. Where he applies this analysis to himself, but then says something about it. He says, often when I'm about to give a lecture to a large number of people, I notice that to my mind, each person in the audience seems to exist in his or her own respective seat,
through his or her own power, rather than existing only through the power of thought, existing only conventionally. They all seem to exist in a condition of exaggerated solidity. This is how they seem, how they appear, how they dawn to my mind. But if they did not exist in this way, they would have to be findable through the type of examination I have just described, whereas they cannot. There's a conflict between how they appear and how they actually exist. Therefore, I call to mind whatever I know about selflessness, reflecting, for instance, on Nagarjuna's statement in his fundamental treatise on the middle called Wisdom, where he examines whether the Buddha inherently exists. Quotes from Nagarjuna. The Buddha is not his mind-body complex. He is not other than his mind-body complex. The mind-body complex is not in him. He is not in it. He does not possess it. What Buddha is there? Nagarjuna uses the Buddha as an example of being selfless, of the absence of an inherently existent person. In the same way, we need to reflect on our own selflessness. When I apply this reflection to myself, I think the monk Tenzin Gyatso is not his mind-body complex. He's not other than his mind-body complex. The mind-body complex is not in him. He is not in it. He does not possess it. What Tenzin Gyatso is there? The monk Tenzin Gyatso is not anything in his mind-body complex, ranging from the top of his head to the soles of his feet. When I see the monk Tenzin Gyatso, nothing is found. Not the visual consciousness, not the hearing consciousness, not the smelling consciousness, not the tasting consciousness, not the body consciousness, not the mental consciousness, not the waking consciousness, not the dreaming consciousness, not the consciousness of deep sleep, and at the end, not even the clear light of death. Are any of these Tenzin Gyatso? None is found to be Tenzin Gyatso. Also, there's nothing outside of the mind-body complex that is Tenzin Gyatso. In addition, Tenzin Gyatso does not depend on the mind-body complex as a separate entity. Like a lion in a grove of trees, also, the mind-body complex does not depend on Tenzin Gyatso as a separate entity, like a forest of trees in snow. Both of these would require that Tenzin Gyatso and the mind-body complex be different entities, and that's impossible. Also, Tenzin Gyatso does not possess the mind-body complex, like a person possessing a cow, which would require different entities, or like a tree possessing its core, which would be the same entity. Then what if Tenzin Gyatso is there? For sure, nothing can be found, not as a part of the mind-body complex, not depending on the mind-body complex as a separate entity, not in possession of the mind-body complex, and not even as a continuum of the mind-body complex. It's clear that the self is merely set up in dependence upon the mind-body complex. This analysis stands in opposition to the way we usually think. When I think I am a monk, there's an appearance in my mind of the monk to whom body and mind belong. We're all humans, that's for sure, but when we identify ourselves as a person, and when we identify someone else as a different person over there, these two appear most concretely. Yet when we apply analysis to determine what the actual person is, when we analyse whether this person is a certain type of mind and body, we do not come up with anything that is the person. Also, it's not possible for something entirely separate from mind and body to be the person. This being the case, this profound Buddhist system teaches us that a person is just set up in dependence on mind and body. When I use this analysis, I understand what originally seemed to be so palpable does not at all exist in this way. The person that appeared to exist so forthrightly just plain cannot be found. This which seemed to exist in itself is seen to depend on thought. Reflecting on this, when I look out at an audience, I see that all these tens of thousands of people are thinking, I, in a way that is in fact mistaken, drawing themselves into trouble. Seeing them in this way helps me and will help you call forth loving concern for beings trapped in misconception. This is often how I begin my lectures. It's just before 10:02. We can move to movement, I think, rather than me start something else. Okay.